Welcome to Broken Law, the podcast about the law, whose interests it serves and whose it does not. Brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Horesca, Senior Advisor for Communications and Strategy at ECS. We are recording this episode amidst the final days of 2022, and so much has happened this year that it can be hard to recall it all and even harder to make sense of it all. Thankfully, my two guests are going to do that for me. I am joined today by Professor Kira M. Bridges from UC Berkeley School of Law and Jennifer Bendery, Senior Politics Reporter for HuffPost. It's going to be hard to fit all of 2022 into one episode, but here goes. Kira and Jen, welcome to Broken Law.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We're really cheery right now, especially Jen, who seems really excited, which is great. And I just want to acknowledge the cheeriness right now because I keep anticipating that this conversation is going to get really dark and depressing. But in the moment, we're excited to at least record, which is great.
Awesome. I don't know that I'm cheery. I'm here. We're alive.
There's a reason to be upbeat. All right. I'm going to start broad and then we can go on any tangents that the two of you would like. We'll start with, when you think back to everything that was 2022, what's the story or development that stands out most to you?
I think the story, the development that stood out most to me is the fact that the Supreme Court is going to be as awful as we anticipated that it was going to be. I think there was like this one term, like, and right after Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed, where we're like, it's not going to be that bad. Like, they're going to go slow. They're going to issue these narrow opinions. They're going to deny standing so as not to hear like very contra. And then like this past term was just like, just kidding. We're going to do everything that you feared and we're going to do it really fast. We're going to interpret the Constitution in the way that the GOP wants it to be interpreted. And that's it. So I think that's the story of 2022.
I think that's a really good way to capture it. Like Samuel Alito, like duct taped the gas pedal to the floor. And it was just like, no matter what we hit, we're just going to keep going.
Right. We're hitting democracy. We're hitting bodily autonomy.
Yeah, exactly.
We're hitting like everything. Yeah. The division between church and state, like everything's like in the path of destruction.
What are your thoughts on that, Jen?
I mean, that's a pretty good one to highlight for the year. The complete and utter political apparatus that the Supreme Court has been all along is now in plain view. So some of us were like, yep, there it is. Now it's much more accessible to people, especially with, I mean, just Roe v. Wade being overturned alone, never mind the broader picture of what the court has done. That alone is pretty earth-shattering. And then like the leak before it, I mean, the whole process was bonkers. The leak of the decision, and then the decision came down, and then the aftermath of the decision and the leaker and the way that the parties on Capitol Hill tried to refocus on like, oh my God, someone leaked it. We must find out who leaked this versus on the other side. Yeah, there was a leak, but also women across the entire country just lost the right to control their bodies. So there was a pretty clear split on the way that the Republicans and Democrats wanted to focus on this for pretty obvious reasons. But yes, I think that the Supreme Court's obvious political role in our country was laid bare this year on a number of levels. And I don't think what else could be bigger this year than that.
Yeah, it's including just in terms of impact, right? Given how locked Congress has repeatedly been on most things, I think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court is arguably the most powerful branch of government right now, and it is to our collective detriment. Kira, you're an expert on reproductive rights. And so much has been said about Dobbs. So much has been written about it. I'm curious to hear what you think now. We're 6 months, 7 months from the decision. How do you think about the impact of that decision? Is it even possible to summarize it?
I'll try. I'm going to do a really bad job of summarizing the impact. But I think in the initial days, weeks, maybe even first couple of months, we had these headlines about just like the fallout from the decision, right? Like 10-year-old survivors of rape being forced to travel long distances to terminate a pregnancy, people being unable to obtain like just like basic health care for like managing a miscarriage, doctors being unsure about whether they can actually intervene or whether we have to wait until sepsis develops or wait until vital signs get unstable, right? And so there was a lot of reporting on that in the first days, weeks, months. And I think now, close to half a year outside of the decision, the stories have disappeared, right? We've moved on to some distractions that the GOP is hanging out, you know, in headlines all over the country, or like, you know, just other real issues. And the tragedy that is forced birth has become like a banality, and it's not newsworthy anymore. But people are still being forced to bear children that they know it is not in their best interest, their family's best interest, their kids' best interest for them to bear. And so it's become kind of just like an ordinary trauma, an ordinary tragedy that no longer gets headlines. This is the moment that I was most afraid of. When every news station was reporting Dobbs and trying to make it accessible to laypersons, like, I was actually afraid of this moment when people would move on and forced birth would just become just another bad thing that happens to marginalized people in this country.
I think that's fair. It was kept alive somewhat by the midterms, right? When it was the question of will it or won't it be a relevant issue for voters, and it turned out to be a very relevant issue for many voters. But now we're post midterms, and like you said, we're moving on to the new Supreme Court term and the new destruction that the court is going to impose.
Jeez, guys,
I appreciate you.
Really?
I told you it's going to get dark
in like
really
5
quick.
Minutes. Come on.
But I think I appreciate the point, which is that forced birth, I think, is a really traumatic term. And it was making headlines. It was actually top of mind for a while. And now, which is just the way of things, no matter how scary an issue, after a while, it becomes normalized.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not the one being forced to do it.
Right, exactly. And that's an invitation, I think, for me to remind folks, like, even before Dobbs was handed down, like, people all over this country were being forced to give birth. But it wasn't by virtue of, like, criminal laws that states had passed that made it illegal to terminate a pregnancy in the borders of that state. Instead, it was the Hyde Amendment. Instead, it was these laws that had the effect of closing clinics and making abortion care inaccessible. We were forcing birth well before Dobbs. Yeah. And it wasn't a story then either, right? Like, I'm sure I wasn't alive then, but I'm sure when the Hyde Amendment was passed, I'm sure when it was upheld in 1980 in Harris versus McRae, perhaps they wrote stories about it then. But by the time, like, I was a young adult, and certainly by the time I was a law professor, people just weren't talking about the brutality of the Hyde Amendment. And let me just back up. And for the uninitiated, the Hyde Amendment is still good law, and it's a provision that prevents federal funds from being used to cover the cost of abortion care. So what that means is that people who receive Medicaid as their health insurance can't rely on their health insurance for this form of health care. Folks who rely upon Indian health services for health care, Native folks, can't turn to this agency that was created to provide, to fulfill a treaty obligation to provide health care to them. They can't turn to that department in order to get basic health care. And so the Hyde Amendment was upheld, the constitutionality was upheld in Harris versus McRae in 1980. And it is a tragedy, right? It means that low-income people can't rely upon their health insurance to cover abortion care, which means that low-income people, unless they manage to scrape together $300, $400, $500, $1,000, $1,500, which many low-income people cannot do, it means that they are going to be forced to give birth to children they don't want to have. And so that tragedy had become a banality in the decades that passed since Harris versus McRae, and people weren't reporting on the tragedy that was the Hyde Amendment. And similarly, there was a lot of attention given to Dobbs in the first weeks, months, and then now I'm afraid about the banality of the tragedy. And it's just it will become accepted as just like a feature of American life, that in this country, sometimes people are forced to give birth when they don't want to.
I can envision this becoming like so many issues, somewhat like gas prices, in that it becomes the center of attention when there's an election and fades from view when there's not an election.
I wonder. Yeah, that's disturbing.
It is. It's very disturbing. It says a lot about how this country operates. We have covered Dobbs on several episodes this year, and so I do want to really encourage listeners to go back and pick up those episodes. I want to make sure we don't depress Jen too much or our listeners.
I would like to add something.
Go for it.
I am not a legal expert. I am a congressional reporter. And I think maybe that combined with me being an optimist at heart gives me a slightly different vantage point on all this. To me, the situation here is, yes, it was a terrible year for abortion rights and for women's rights and for human rights. But to me, the question is not, let's look at how bad it is and talk about it, which is important to understand the full spectrum of how bad this is. Yes. But I think about like, well, what now? Okay. Like, what are people supposed to do now? And especially in Washington, D.C., this is where people can do things. It doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. It's been a terrible year on this front. Terrible, terrible, historically terrible. But now what? And this is a question that I have had posed to me rhetorically by Democratic senators struggling to figure out what to do, because they, off record, have talked to some of us women reporters on the Hill to get our gauge of this issue. And we understand the congressional process and how policymaking happens. And there have been conversations about this, which is strange, like to have a senators talk to you off record about what you think should happen. But it has happened this year with some like fairly prominent reporters and senators. Yeah. But all this to say, I think to me, the way I look at it is now what? And there are things happening that will continue to happen on this. It's not just like a thing that happened and it just fades away. It does to an extent. I agree. But for example, there are currently members of Congress and senators who have been pushing bills to try to protect certain pieces of things, right? For example, like medication abortion, like that was the next thing that some Democratic lawmakers immediately focused on in terms of we've got to pass a bill right now protecting abortion medication. Because that's how...
But Jen, do you think there's a chance in hell that any pro-abortion legislation passes? And there's two parts to this. One, we have like 24 hours left of the lame duck, which is probably the last chance because no pro-abortion legislation is going to get through the next House. And I think it was obviously great to see the Respect for Marriage Act enacted, but I think it's telling that got bipartisan support and was pretty quickly passed in Washington terms, but there is no bipartisan abortion legislation.
Yes. And are you surprised by that?
No, but I mean, I think that's where the depression comes from, is like,
so, okay.
The now what is literally now what?
Correct. And you have to use the cards you've been dealt. I recognize that in the next 2 years, the Republican-controlled House is not going to pass anything that protects abortion rights. However, at this stage, you've got a Democratic-controlled Senate and a Democrat in the White House, which means, okay, this is about damage control right now. And it's also about the Supreme Court. And perhaps you guys have started to notice there's been a little surge of activity on this issue of it's time for Sotomayor to step down. It's time for, I saw today someone saying it's time for Elena Kagan to step down. Because this is the two-year window when they could, in theory, be replaced by a much younger, Democratic-supported justice that Biden would pick. This is just, it's just one piece of this. And so my point in all this is that the what now question, you have to look at it from a pragmatic standpoint, too. Like, what can you do now? What now? Instead of focusing on all the bad. It's like, well, there are certain things you can prevent from happening right now. And there are certain proactive things that could happen in D.C., that will take some push, but there is still the possibility to do them. So to me, it's the ebbs and flows, and you have to take the cards you've been dealt and figure out what can I do with this now.
The only, I don't know, calling it a plus makes me angry. The one development that I think is worthwhile to know in this case is ACS has been saying for months, even before Dobbs, that SCOTUS is in a full-fledged legitimacy crisis and needs to be reformed. And I think the past year has taken Supreme Court reform from being kind of a niche issue or even a fringe issue to being mainstream, right? Public confidence in the court has plummeted. It is at historic lows. as Jen noted, there's more and more congressional hearings being done about the court, from ethics reform to court expansion. And so that conversation, I think, really took a step forward in reaction to Dobbs. Is Supreme Court reform going to happen in the next Congress? No, it's not. But the debate is certainly much more front of mind and mainstream than it was 6 months ago.
Yes, I think that's very true. I also agree that I don't see anything, any major reforms coming for the Supreme Court anytime soon. Yeah. But even today, I saw bubbling up on social media, I think it was Congressman Kevin Brady from Texas was at some press conference and was saying, like, the danger of forcing Donald Trump's tax returns to be released is what comes next. The Supreme Court justices have to have their tax returns released. And the overwhelming response to that was like, yes, we should see their tax returns. So I think there is, yes, the momentum has shifted on this issue, just not to the point where I think anyone is prepared to do anything major to the Supreme Court. That feels like a big push.
Kira, can I ask you to try and answer that question of what now, given that Congress is going to be basically out of the question in a few hours once the lame duck is done? We're looking more at state level action. Is there, for listeners who are trying to find a positive or trying to find a, like, what can I do? How do you think about that now?
I really appreciate Jen's optimism. I really do. But just staying on the federal level for a minute, had Congress like spring into action, I would have been like, okay, awesome. The Supreme Court is not the final arbiter of people's bodily autonomy. But we had Congress spring into action after Shelby County versus Holder and like protected voting rights after the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by forcing Section 4B into desuetude. Like had Congress done something, then the Supreme Court wouldn't have to be the last line of defense for democracy. And, you know, not to mention just like fundamental rights and things that one needs in order to be kind of like fully human and have one's dignity. But we just haven't seen it. And then of course we won't see it for another 2 years, given the composition of Congress. So of course things might come in the future. Who knows? Like things might come in the future from this current Supreme Court. Chief Justice Roberts walking around like a moderate these days, right? Like when I teached about the Lochner era in law schools, there was a Justice Roberts that switched his vote and the Lochner era came to an end. So anything's possible, but the question is like, what's likely? And I'm just not optimistic that we are likely to see anything good out of either the court or Congress. But when it comes to the state level, right, we see like a whole bunch of surprise victories with voters in states that we wouldn't imagine voting to protect abortion rights in their constitutions and things of that nature. So there seems to be a lot more activity and possibility on the state level. But that being said, like, voters on the state level still need to be able to vote. The Supreme Court has done a beautiful job of making it so that state legislatures can disenfranchise people and prevent them from casting a ballot in elections. So hopefully the people who are able to vote in these states will protect the things that are dear to marginalized folks.
And I promise not to spend this entire episode bashing Congress. That's not the intent. But I do think that congressional inaction has empowered the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court honestly thought that it would be checked by Congress, that Congress would jump into action and rectify bad decisions, I'm not sure the court would be as just blatantly ridiculous as it is. But they know Congress isn't going to do that.
Congress has never done that. Congress has never done this. This was never the game. Never.
And in theory, we have checks and balances, but we really don't. Like, it really does end with the Supreme Court. And that
does.
Well, actually, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act came to mind back in the 70s when the Supreme Court's like, discrimination on the basis of pregnancy is not discrimination on the basis of sex. And then Congress was like, actually, it is. So, hey, 1970s, that was the golden era.
50 years ago.
Yeah.
No. to be clear, in case that was what it sounded like I was saying, my comments on Congress were not in any way to defend them or their ability to hold the Supreme Court in check or in being particularly effective. What I think is worth looking at is the fact that Congress still has people in both parties and it still gums itself up. And they still, in the end, Democrats can prevent a lot of things from happening just by virtue of being there and by controlling the Senate and the White House. It's not gains per se in the realm of reproductive rights and protecting women's bodies, but there are inherent checks and balances in there that are working right now, even though it's been a shitty year. Sorry if you can't say that on here. I don't even know what your rules are.
No, trust me. We swear frequently on this.
Oh, why didn't you tell me this before? It's fine. Yeah. Oh my God. Okay.
Now what the fuck, Jean?
I'm so sorry. I should have said that from the top.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. ACS is a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization committed to protecting our democratic legitimacy and supporting laws and legal systems that improve the lives of all people. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. Our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By joining ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, our advocacy in support of Supreme Court reform and truth, racial healing, and transformation, and so much more. You also become a member of our nationwide network, which includes over 250 student and lawyer chapters. Join ACS and the progressive legal movement today by visiting our website at acslaw.org/membership. And now back to the conversation.
All right. I do want to get on to other topics. And we did note that Dobbs went from being really covered to being not covered. But there are also stories that have been generally underreported on all year long. And I just want to take a minute to talk about some of those. From what's a story, maybe it's local, maybe it's from your state, that has seemed really monumental, either good or bad, that you think has gone underreported this year?
I think that, and this probably isn't most news outlets' jobs, but I would have loved to see more media coverage of the connection between Dobbs, the just proliferation of attacks on trans folks, and then connecting those attacks to what was all the rage last summer, which was the war on CRT, critical race theory. Like, I just would have loved, because like these things happened, right? And the attacks on trans folks and the reversal of Roe like happened in the same period of time. But then like, it wasn't that long ago that I swear you could not walk two steps without bumping into somebody accusing you of like peddling critical race theory. And so like, I would have loved to see like more. And again, I say that maybe this isn't what the news outlets are supposed to do, just but like more theorizing about like why, like what is the connection between all of these things? Are they really just like sort of discrete, like culture wars, or is there a thread that connects these culture wars? Yeah. And, you know, of course, in my view, there's a thread that connects them.
Yes, most definitely.
Right. And so perhaps I would have loved to see more reporting to make that thread more accessible to people who are interested in learning about it.
I appreciate that. That's been one of mine, is that I've seen a lot of state reporting on attacks on trans youth, particularly because of the slew of state legislation that we've seen attacking trans youth. But most of it's been state specific because it's coming out of state legislatures. Jen, you do politics. How do you think of this, including the obvious political links between these different topics?
I mean, things are always connected. I mean, I think of even with not to spend this whole time talking about Dobbs, but I even think about the comments that I think it was Thomas who wrote, it basically connecting all these different cases, saying they should all be revisited, like Obergefell, like. There was like one sentence in this, in his opinion, that connected all these major landmark decisions saying they should all be revisited. Like, that was like,
well, it was one of the reasons that we did get the Respect for Marriage Act. And like one of the few times Congress was like, oh shit, we have to.
Well, that is entirely the reason why Congress acted. That's it. They would not have done this otherwise. Yeah. But, and that connects to what I think was something I wish there had been more time spent on, is that kind of the dissolution of Republican opposition to same-sex marriage, because that was a bonkers vote that just happened in the Senate and in the House even. Like, they just, there's been a lot going on in this Respect for Marriage Act bill just popped up and like went right through during the lame duck when other stuff was going on, like big things like keeping the government running and this omnibus bill that just came out this week, like big packages that are must pass bills. And then a bill to legalize same-sex marriage. Like, I mean, technically it didn't legalize same-sex marriage. It put some protections in place for same-sex marriage, but I would like to have seen more reporting on kind of a deeper dive on like how, what happened to the Republican Party on this issue? When did that slip? And when did, more importantly to me, more interestingly, when did it become comfortable for Republican politicians to go on record supporting something like this? Because I've covered Congress for like 15 years. And I remember, I mean, it hasn't been that long since they've had other votes on major issues related to LGBTQ rights where it was like, nope, maybe you'd get like one or two Senate Republicans on it and maybe a handful of Republicans in the House. And this time there were like 40 something Republicans on board with this Respect for Marriage Act in the House. And then like 11 or 12 senators, one of which was Cynthia Lummis, who's extremely conservative Republican from Wyoming, who like really ate shit to take this vote and talked about it, how she was just clobbered by outside groups before, during, and after her vote. And she was like, I'm doing this anyway, because I mean, she gave this floor speech that was remarkable, saying that she's, you know, it's, we have reached a level of incivility and disgusting language and treatment of each other that, if anything, we need to support this bill to restore some semblance of tolerance and acceptance of our differences. So for me, that is something I wish someone had taken the time to look at. How did we get here? Where, when did that suddenly become okay?
And why aren't we there on abortion? Because the go-to answer is like public support. Well, public support for abortion consistently is majority support. And so why is it that,
I mean, you could say the same about background checks on guns. That has like 95% support and it still hasn't passed. So
yeah, it's not a culture war issue.
Public support is not equal to the support in Congress.
So when I teach Obergefell and my classes in family law, as well as in reproductive rights and justice, I observe the heteronormativity of the decision. Like, these were like the most heteronormative plaintiffs. Like, they were pretty much straight couples, except they were gay, right? And there's like this respectability politics, like pulsing through Justice Kennedy's opinion. And he's essentially arguing that same-sex couples are just like us. So I think, I wonder, right, as we think about the Respect for Marriage Act and its, and the support that it got from Republicans in Congress, I wonder if we can attribute some of that support to like the way that Obergefell was framed as really a decision that protects like the most privileged and heteronormative of same-sex couples. And then I would put that in conversation with the attacks on trans people. So it's like, what, did we just switch out like boogeymen? Like, did we just trade one actor that's responsible for the fall of civilization for another? Like, it's no longer gay folks who love each other enough to get married. Instead, it's trans people.
So we did switch. That's exactly what we did as a culture. Because they tend to pick on the least protected, least empowered people they can find. And it used to be gay people who were wanted to be out and be with each other. And now gay people and same-sex couples have protections and a community. And it's much more accepted. You've had presidents of the United States supporting it. It's become a thing globally where same-sex marriage is legal in increasing number of places. But with trans folks, like they don't have that. It's not there yet. And so they're the easiest next target. Who has the least amount of protection? Who's the most vulnerable? Who's the easiest to bully? And
especially trans youth.
Yes, absolutely.
Trans students are the most marginal because kids can't speak for themselves.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. And so I hope that we, and by we, I mean like folks who are interested in like justice, like I hope we use this as like a pedagogical moment. Like, let us learn, right? Because it really breaks my heart that, as Jen said, like the most marginalized, the most vulnerable folks in the country right now are just like being as attacked as they are. It's really hard to live through this moment, right? As just like a person with a sense of decency. And the other thing that I wanted to just mention, based on what you guys were saying about public support for abortion and public support for background checks. I wonder, right? Like when I was saying earlier about the Hyde Amendment has been good law, we've been forcing births well before Dobbs. I think that this country is very comfortable with people being forced to bear children they don't want to bear, right? Like, and I think that explains why this tragedy has become a banality. People have been bearing children they don't want to bear, like at least since the founding of the nation. And so while this might have been like a spectacular moment, like a very visible moment of this feature of our country, it's something that we've all lived with. And we've been very comfortable with living with that. So I think that the Supreme Court is meeting the energy of society more broadly. Like, it is handing down decisions that are consistent with how people feel.
I think one of the points of Dobbs is that forced birth became an issue when white women were suddenly forced to bear birth, right? It, as you noted, forced birth has always been part of American society. It was just a question of whether the law, the legal right to abortion was available to the upper echelons of society. And so when suddenly white women were denied the right to abortion, then it became an issue.
Right. Yeah. So what Dobbs does is, like, I call it democratizing suffering. Like, suffering used to be like concentrated among low-income people, among people of color, among people with disabilities, among non-undocumented people, young people. And so what Dobbs does is sort of democratize it a little bit, right? Like, not completely, because privileged folks will travel, right? Like, have passport, will travel. They'll always be able, like, and this was true before Roe was handed down, they've always been able to access safe abortion, if not legal abortion, safe abortion, and they'll continue to do so. So Dobbs just democratizes it a little bit. But
is that the silver lining of Dobbs?
Yes.
Democracy. Well,
I absolutely believe that, like, if more people suffered, then we would actually do something, right? Like, I think that's the point of the Equal Protection Clause. Treat everybody alike so that when everybody's treated poorly, like, we'll actually be moved to do something. There it is. We got there. We got to the optimism.
I don't want to call that good news. I want actual good news. Okay. So I'm going to force a good news story, because I am the one that is always prone to the most cynical view of the year.
Yeah, this has been a downer, guys.
I know. I remember in 2020. Do you remember when everybody was like, is 2020 over? Right, because it can't get worse than this. And then 2021, and it was like, when is 2021 going to be over? And just
guys,
like, take it to every year.
You have the wrong.
When is this going to be over?
2020 was the worst. The worst. Are you kidding me?
It was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. Yeah.
But again, like, this year was so bad.
We had Joe Biden in the White House. We did not have Trump in the White House. Have
Absolutely.
You forgotten this no. major Wait, piece?
Thank you for this. Thank you, Jen. No, thank you. Because we have to be reminded of where we have been.
We have come a long way from the disintegration of this country. We're still maybe on the rocks, but oh my God, we've had no Trump for 2 years.
Yes. And optimism, like, the midterms were great, right?
The midterms were a huge overall success for Democrats. And you can't overlook the things that have been accomplished in the last 2 years. One of which is something that I cover, which are judges who get confirmed to lifetime seats on federal courts. Biden has, like, absolutely, like, changed the way that judges are put on the courts. He has nominated and confirmed, like, 90, maybe even 100 at this point, judges to lifetime seats who are overwhelmingly Black women, people of color, LGBTQ. And he's got another 2 years where it's going to get even easier. Because even though there's only a one seat difference in the Senate, it makes a world of difference for confirming judges. So that alone is good news if you care about the federal bench being diverse, if you care about the bench reflecting America, if you care about fairness and equality and diversity. I mean, that alone is a big deal. So guys, snap out of it, man. That's just one thing. And you didn't bring it up at all. Come on, guys. You're a lawyer. You work for ACS. I'm just a reporter.
But you also had another good news story that I want to give you a chance to highlight, because that is a really good news story, including out of this, like, crazy political climate that we're living in.
There are actually a few good news stories, because it depends on the news you like to read and share. Just going to leave that with you guys. Wake up.
Wait, Jen, hold on a second. That's victim blaming. I feel like you're blaming us
for not being happier. I am blaming you. You don't feel like it. I am blaming you.
We're reading the wrong news.
So the good news story is, which I was telling Jean right before we started taping, like 6 or so months ago, I wrote a piece about how we have a network of tribal schools across America where Native American kids on tribal lands go to school. All these schools are run by the Bureau of Indian Education. The government is, if anyone's listening who doesn't know this whole system, it's the U.S. government is in charge of running education for tribes. Thanks to treaties and the way this whole country was founded, that's the way it goes. They've been chronically underfunded, neglected forever. And I wrote a piece about 6 months ago about how, hey, Congress could do something to fix all these crumbling, literally crumbling, falling apart, toxic schools, housing tens of thousands of children across the country. But Congress is choosing not to spend the money to fix these schools. And I profiled one school in particular as I gave a bigger picture take on this. And this one school was arguably in the worst shape of all of the tribal schools around the country. It's in New Mexico. It's about 35 miles outside of Albuquerque. It's in a little town called like Tehachapi. And I talked to the congresswoman from this district, Melanie Stansberry, and getting money for this school, this neglected, unsafe, chronically underfunded school that used to be an Indian boarding school. So it has trauma all wrapped up in the school itself. This one school became the number one priority for Congresswoman Melanie Stansberry of New Mexico to get funded. So for the last year and a half, her literally her top priority as a congresswoman has been to find a way to get money to this school to rebuild it because it's built in a floodplain and it just has layers of problems. And never mind getting a good education here. This is just like the whole school is falling apart and it's not okay. So I did this piece 6 months ago. I talked to her. I had pictures from the school basically being flooded, a building being condemned, kids having to go home on a bus. The piece ran, you know, it did okay. Like people don't often want to read about this kind of stuff. It's not flashy or sexy, but it's real and it's important. So then fast forward to yesterday when the omnibus spending bill dropped, and it's something like 4,155 pages, this huge end of year spending bill that just dropped yesterday. There's one sentence in this bill, that fully funds that school. And it's the only line item. It's the only line item in the entire bill for a school to get construction, a tribal school to get money to be constructed. And it's full funding for the school to be completely relocated out of the floodplain and rebuilt. And that is the product of this one congresswoman's year and a half of pretty obsessive, nonstop, if desperate, lobbying of House appropriators, congressional leadership, the White House, the Department of Interior, and this one freshman lawmaker woke up yesterday morning and saw the bill released just like the rest of us when it was publicly released, quickly went through the bill and found it. And it's that one line item is for her school. So
amazing.
That's the good news. The school can immediately get
that
done.
That is excellent news.
And she cried. She cried when she read it. She cried on the phone with me. And she said she can leave Congress now if it came down to it because this was the most important thing she could do.
Wow.
So that was good news.
Yeah, that's amazing news. Oh my God. Yeah, that puts a little pep in my little step.
There you go.
Change is possible. Yeah.
What an incredible public servant to just be relentless on that issue.
She was. And honestly, there's probably almost no one in Congress who could have done a better job than her because this woman, Melanie Stansberry, she's a freshman Democrat from New Mexico. She took Deb Haaland's former seat, but she used to work for OMB. So she knows the budget process. In fact, she was in charge of the budget, the annual budget for the Bureau of Indian Education. So she really knows like the weeds of how that budget works. So she did that for years for Obama. And then she also worked on the Senate Natural Resources Committee, I think, with Maria Cantwell. So she is someone who came into Congress, having been a Senate staffer who worked on issues related to land and education, and also worked at OMB on the budget for Indian education schools. So this is, and she's relatively young. So she just landed in Congress and hit the ground running on this one issue. And so she knew exactly how structurally and process-wise to make this happen. And she did it. But she didn't know until yesterday morning that it worked. Like she was just hoping. And so she said she's been crying, like her staff was crying. She was on the phone all morning calling like literally the school principal, the school, like the manager of like construction, like calling the tribal leaders. like wow. literally calling people crying together about it. So that was a win.
Yeah, totally.
That was a huge win. And Kiara, that's like, can you top that?
Oh my God.
She already did. Well, she told us that the silver lining on Dobbs is that everyone is now at risk.
Were you not listening? I feel like...
You heard it here first.
No. It's hard for me to process Dobbs as a good news story. I mean,
Kiara here showed us the silver lining.
No, I think my silver lining is to not say anything, because when Jen was telling this amazing story and you had the nerve to mention Deb Holland, I just, versus Holland, was just like, don't forget about me. I'm coming down this term. And for everyone who doesn't know, it's the Supreme Court's opportunity to got the Indian Child Welfare Act.
Oh, here we go.
This is a good news segment. I'm not going to mention it.
I just want to note to listeners. So we have a full episode on it.
My silver lining was I was not going to mention it. So there it is. Good news at the end of 2023.
A silver lining for listeners. Right. They don't have to listen to more of it. Yes. But I do encourage them to get the other episode
totally.
And hear just how depressing and scary that case is.
Absolutely.
I will note, when we did this episode last year, Melissa Murray also struggled to come up with good news. And her good news was that she got a dog. And I was like, that is... As somebody who just adopted a puppy, I will take that kind of good news.
Yeah.
You get it where you can.
Yeah,
you guys, I'm just going to say, there is good news all the time. It's easy to focus on the big, bad stuff. And there should be attention on it. There should. I'm a reporter. I focus on a lot of it. But there's always good news, too. And you have to find it.
And I think, like, the good news is that the awful things that the Supreme Court is doing and the inaction of Congress is actually, like, sparking, inciting people to, like, actually do stuff and get involved. Although all of these states have passed these laws that attempted to disenfranchise people of color and others who would vote for Democrats, like, it didn't work, right? Surely people were disenfranchised, but, you know, folks still turned out. Folks attempted to and many times succeeded in overcoming the obstacles that were, like, intentionally placed in front of them to prevent them from casting a ballot. So, yeah, people are excited. You know, the energy has been generated. They hopefully are looking into getting involved on the ground, community organizations, social movements. And that's the sort of energy that we always need, because if we look at institutions like the Supreme Court or Congress or the executive branch to save us, like, we will lose. But if we look to save ourselves, we'll always win.
So with that, I'm going to give you both a quick chance to say what's going to come in 2023. What is your, like, 1-2 sentence prediction? And I have a feeling we're going to get a, like, good news, bad news version
of this, let me go first, which
I'm going to love. I love the dichotomy.
Let me go first, because I am going to do bad news. The Supreme Court's going to gut Grutter versus Bollinger. Race-based affirmative action will be deemed inconsistent with the Equal Protection Clause, preventing universities, colleges, probably employers, from being race conscious in hiring and admission. So that's going to happen. But the good news is that people will be excited to do something about that. And we'll see the different forms that excitement will take.
And I will also note, we also have an episode on that case as well. But I think you could say that the bad news version of 2023 is the Supreme Court is going to prove that it is the worst version of itself yet again.
Right. Absolutely.
I think that's
safe. And the good news is that I've said that already, so the Supreme Court will prove me right. So that's great news.
If only it worked that
way. This has gotten incredibly twisted.
Okay, Jen, we need you to provide the, like, final good note. Give us the, like, how is 2023 going to actually defy expectations and be a
amazing
good year?
Well, I can speak to the congressional trajectory. I think Congress will be jammed and barely anything will get done because it's a divided Congress now. But I think that means that in the Senate, and I know this means this in the Senate, that Chuck Schumer is going to step up the pace even more on confirming Biden's judges to lifetime seats. And if you have followed what they've been doing at all with judges for the past 2 years, you know that Biden has already gotten a historic number of judges confirmed. Like, the pace he's moving is faster than a lot of past presidents have moved at this point, but the diversity of his judges are off the charts in terms of race, gender, ethnicity, but also their professional diversity is all over the place, which is, for anyone who cares about what the courts look like and who's on them, it's a big deal. And it's for decades. These people will be there, as both of you know already. So I think something that will happen in 2023 is an accelerated pace on an already fast clip of judicial confirmations with a pretty exciting mix of people to see get lifetime judgeships.
And that is one of ACS's absolute top priorities and one of the things we spend the most time on. So again, Jen, I'm going to hire you to do advertisements for ACS and just promote judicial confirmation.
You guys are you're too dark for me, man.
Which is why we had you on, because we needed somebody to not make sure that this was just 1 hour of the worst, because I tend to get to the very worst dark place.
Well, you know, today is the darkest day of the year.
Oh, so it's appropriate.
It seems very fitting that we had the conversation that we did.
But you know what? I will add, because it is the darkest day of the year, that means it only gets brighter from here.
Oh my gosh, Jen, are you like this all the time?
That is the best line on which to end this episode. It's going to get brighter from here, guys, literally, if not politically. Right. All right. Thank you both so much. I wish you the best end of your year and a bright and happy, cheery 2023.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again to Kiera and Jen for joining me for this end-of-year wrap-up episode. Given our conversation, I want to encourage listeners to go back and catch our multiple episodes about Dobbs and the Supreme Court's previous and current terms if you haven't listened to those already. We have several on abortion rights from throughout 2022. You can catch all of our previous episodes wherever you're listening to this one. And if you forgot to get a gift for a friend or family member this holiday season, or maybe for a birthday, don't worry, we all do it. Recommend Broken Law to them. It costs nothing and will give them hours of excellent podcast episodes to listen to. Make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law and hashtag Broken Law Podcast. You can also find our episodes and show notes on our website, acslaw.org/podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.